today. What happens when your primary school child develops an eating disorder? And is it time to ban hands-free phones in cars?
I look at parents with young, very young children and think, you don't know how simple things are for you right now. You're in control of everything as a parent of a toddler or a baby. You decide when they eat, how they eat, what they eat.
It's funny because the other day I was sitting somewhere and I've got three boys who were 6, 3 and 1. Yeah. And I met someone who had three boys, the youngest of whom was 6. Yeah. And I looked at her and I said, oh, you're out of the woods. And she just turned around to me and she went, No, I'm just in a different wood.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it.
I know. I thought, oh God, the wood just keeps going on. All right, but before
that's
we get
Maggie.
Into the woods, let's start.
She and her husband James have four daughters. They want to talk about the time that their oldest, Hattie, began severely restricting the amount she ate and exercising obsessively. Eating disorders in young people can be life-threatening, and that wasn't the case for Hattie. But what makes her case unusual is the age at which it began, when she was just 9 and at primary school. Behaviour like this in children that young is rare, but some doctors we have spoken to say they are seeing more cases in their clinics. Maggie and James want to share their experience because they feel it tells us something about the pressures on girls, the impact on families, and the services that can help. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, helping a 9-year-old to recover from an eating disorder. Maggie and James are not the real names of the parents. We've changed all the identities in this episode, which actually isn't about how people parent, but about anxiety, supporting a loved one, and recovery. You may find parts of their story difficult to listen to. Maggie, what was Hattie like as a little girl?
My husband has always said that she's the sunshine, and the sun comes out when she walks into the room. She's just has always been a very jolly presence to have around. I mean, to the point of being irritating. So she's kind of like...
You find her smiling irritating?
I find her singing the same song over and over again. Any particular song that it happens to be on that day will get sung until you have to beg for it to stop.
James describes an incredibly strong connection to his oldest daughter.
There were elements of me that I could see in her in the way that she behaved. She puts up a fight, she disagrees, just because she likes the battle.
You like a scrap?
Yeah, we do like a scrap.
So she was your firstborn, and have you had other children?
Yes, I've got three other girls. And one of them is very close in age to Hattie. Her name's Orla, and she's just 11 months younger than her. They were quite difficult to differentiate in terms of their character.
When did you start to notice that there might be an issue with food?
I think probably around the age of 9, I think, was when it first started. They were doing kind of healthy eating stuff at school, and she stopped eating anything in between meals. She would refuse to have ice creams and treat-type foods.
And when kids get hungry, they also often get quite difficult.
Yeah, so she would get very, very temperamental because she was so hungry, and she would fly off the handle, and it gives you, as a parent, a feeling of utter helplessness because you can't force your child to eat. So then she started kind of cutting down her portion sizes, and I noticed her doing things like checking her ribs and sucking in her stomach. And so she was doing that kind of obsessive sort of checking of her body.
For James, things began to change with a gift.
For Christmas, before it all kicked off, we were really keen to make sure that they had music from amazing, strong female artists. And we got Hattie a Beyoncé album. And she loved it. They began to do lots of dancing in their rooms. And my first recognition that there was something going a bit weird was it suddenly became obvious that Hattie was taking herself away and was doing dancing. It would turn out that she was doing that rather than doing other things, and it was at weird times, and bit by bit it became apparent that she was using this dancing for something other than just the pleasure of listening to Beyoncé.
There was a lot of kind of exercising going on. During that time, she would never walk anywhere. She would always run, which, you know, you think is normal for a child until you say, can you just walk with me? And they can't.
And did you talk to her about this at any point?
So, yeah, the whole way through. But there comes a point where the way that you're talking to the child is a kind of a begging. What I remember is kind of going into her bedroom as she's going to bed and just going, please, can all this stop now? And like, and crying.
But would she say, I'm not hungry, or I want to be thin?
She wasn't hungry. No, she didn't really say that she wanted to be thin. It wasn't expressed like that. She was only 9.
As time went on, Hattie's behaviour became more extreme, cutting out additional food groups and becoming more and more obsessive about exercise. This in itself was alarming for her parents, but adding to the stress was that her closest sister, Orla, began to mirror the behaviour, and Hattie's weight continued to drop.
You know, this thing kicks in, and I remember a photo that my mum took of Hattie when this was right in the sort of bad times, of Hattie holding a plate of fruit, a sort of fruit salad. But she looked, you know, her face, this girl had gone from being rounded and beautiful to sort of drawn and pale. And you could see, you know, she looked thin.
As a dad, how did you feel? I mean, I can see that you were both incredibly emotional, are incredibly emotional.
I don't claim that there's a different thing about, you know, mums or dads in this. But I felt there's a particular thing about being a dad of girls in the current climate, and it's also an amazing time to be a girl, but it's also you know, from my perspective, it looks like a terrifying time to be a girl.
And why is it terrifying?
Just because I think how they look is under scrutiny. At the same time, there's all these opportunities that if they don't take advantage of and find their, you know, realise themselves in some profound way, they will feel that they have not done their duty as girls, you know. And body positivity was something we set out quite deliberately to try and make that something that my kids, you know, experienced.
When did you first get external help?
One of the things that I'm most proud about was that we got help really as early as we knew there was a problem. The local child and adolescent mental health service, CAMHS, they have an eating disorder service, and we were seen for an assessment within 2 weeks of having been referred, and it was such an enormous relief to actually have someone say, yes, we think there is a problem, you're not imagining it. I think by the time we went there, she understood that she had a problem.
When we got into therapy, it became apparent that one of the things that terrified Hattie was the idea of being fat, you know, pure terror. There's one occasion where we were at a friend's house, and we were just about to go out for a walk, and I remember being in the bathroom of this friend's house, just trying to get her to put an oat cake in her mouth. It was utterly awful. She couldn't do it. She wouldn't open her mouth. Eventually, she did, and she took a bite of this thing, and just the absolute visceral terror in her eyes as she was rolling this thing around her mouth. So I don't think that the thing was about body image, but it is about health and weight, definitely.
When you go to these sessions, they always weigh the child, and if the child goes below a certain line, then they get really worried And I remember on the day she had gone below that line, I remember the therapist saying to her, "Are you feeling very weak?" And I remember Hattie just nodding. She had dark circles under her eyes and she wasn't sleeping well.
I just remember it being a pretty devastating moment for all of us, because it was this sort of very visual proof of how bad things had got.
In the end, Hattie was diagnosed with an unspecified eating disorder in which she suffered serious and worrying weight loss that triggered further intervention, but she avoided a hospital admission. Maggie says she knows this wasn't the most serious form of the disorder and has met parents whose experiences involved inpatient care and hospitalisation, but watching her daughter develop it and grappling with the behaviour became all-consuming for the family.
It was all we talked about. It just completely took over family life.
You know, Did you feel angry?
Yeah, I felt really angry with her a lot. I've got letters that Hattie wrote me apologising for her, what she was doing to the family. I feel guilty.
Did it affect her friendships?
Yeah, I remember she went for a play date with a friend of hers, and her friend said to her, "What do you like doing?" And Hattie had said, "I like jumping up and down." And her friend said, "Let's do that then." And they just jumped up and down. That's all that she could think of to say that she liked doing at that time. She didn't know what else to do. And one of the things about having a child with an eating disorder is that other parents are kind of horrified by the idea that it could happen to their child. And so they always ask things like, "What made that happen then?" Which is possibly the worst question that you could be asked, because you're already blaming yourself. We ask that question of ourselves all the time, but it's not, I feel really strongly that it's not anything to do with the way that you parent. If your child ends up with this type of condition, it's an illness like any other. We had this really amazing therapist, and over time she did start showing some improvement, and it felt as though she made a decision at one point to start eating more again. She saw such an improvement in Hattie that she discharged us, and we were, and it was coming up for summer, and we were like, "Oh, brilliant, all behind us, we can kind of carry on with our lives."
The support that the family secured was helping, but the change didn't last long.
We went probably through a period of about 8 months where she was well, and then winter happened. Being outside less, we noticed that she was doing a lot of really serious exercise. Her disorder had taken a slightly different form. She cut out again all treat foods. She started exercising absolutely obsessively, and she did this thing where she would just jump up and down all the time. She'd push her arms up on the arms of the chair so that her whole body was floating a few inches off the chair. So there was never a time where she wasn't using up energy. The time when I really realised that we had a problem was when I woke up one morning, probably about 4:30, 5 o'clock, and I could hear her exercising in her room. And I just went into her room and I was like, "Hattie, what are you doing?" And she was doing burpees in her bedroom up early in the morning.
And how old was she?
10.
A 10-year-old doing burpees?
Yeah.
I couldn't bear the sight of her running, because I knew that her running was an excuse for more exercise. You know, anything where, look at me, watch me, Dad, I would stop her from doing that stuff.
And what about your relationship with Maggie?
In retrospect, going through this with Maggie has made both of us much stronger. I really felt that this was a thing we did in partnership, and we took decisions together. and we basically agreed on all the important stuff. We agreed that we needed to work with cams, we needed to change the way that we were approaching this thing. I think we sort of backed each other up, and I think that was really important.
Our relationship wasn't the thing that suffered. It was just family life that suffered, because all the fun went out of life. There just wasn't any laughter in the house anymore, and you can't have fun when that's going on.
You had this hopeful summer. You really thought things were on the up. When you started seeing these habits again, what did you think?
Well, it was really distressing, you know, begging her to stop again and getting very angry. So I referred us back. I called up the CAM service. The therapist that we saw was a slightly different type of therapist, who was a behavioural psychologist, and he treated it as a kind of anxiety type behaviour. But it was also, I mean, she had anorexic thought patterns as well. I think one of the things that the therapy helped us with was being more sympathetic to the child's point of view. One of his theories is that if a child's feeling very worried about something, or they're just generally anxious, that they will find ways of dealing with that makes them feel better. Hattie's jumping up and down was a way of dealing with her anxious feelings.
So you've basically found out that your daughter suffers from anxiety, and it happens to have this outlet, which is a food-related outlet.
Yeah, exactly. They said it was an unspecified eating disorder. People think they know what an eating disorder is. They think they know what mental health conditions are, but I don't think they could ever imagine the particular condition that Hattie had. These things come in lots of different forms, and they're really painful in whatever form they come in. So what the therapy did for us, particularly this time around, was to give us positive ways of handling the situation. So positive reinforcement of the right behaviours, and giving, you know, literally star charts to give Hattie other ways of dealing with her anxiety. So it would be things like very detailed colouring.
Every single step of this was a fight for all of us. She would battle us every single way, but ultimately she did want to get better. But we would have to say, okay, you're gonna sit down, and you're gonna sit down for 5 seconds, and you're gonna do that for 3 days. And we would time 5 seconds. And then we'd extend it to 10, and then we'd extend it to 20.
Without pushing up,
actually putting her weight through. And she would do it under real duress, and she would leap up the moment the 5 seconds were over, and she'd resent it every step of the way.
She has just worked on it. We're now in a more sustainable place, and we have now been discharged from CAMS, you know, several years ago. But it hasn't gone. She still doesn't eat sweet things or ice cream, but she snacks in between meals. She doesn't do useless exercise, although she does a lot of fun exercise with her friends. So everything is much more healthy.
Do you think about, and I'm cautious to say it because I'm not, think I'm with you, you know, I don't, no one's blaming you, but looking back as a parent, would you have done things differently?
I would have. The thing I would do now differently is to just not be bothered at all about what it is that they're eating. As long as they're enjoying their food, I would have only emphasised how important it is to love your food.
So don't give food a status.
Yeah, just say, oh, it's really great that you love your food. But maybe we just won't eat any more of that. It's good to like everything, isn't it? Let's have some carrots. I think there is more focus on making sure that your children eat healthily, and that it's the right things, and it's organic, and it's kind of, you know.
Do you think that's a bad thing?
Yeah, I do.
You should feel a bit more relaxed about the fact that they want that ice cream.
Yeah, let them have it. It's really nice that they want it. But I do, I feel really strongly that no parent should think it's because I was keen to get them eating healthily that my child has now got an eating disorder. That's not at all what I think.
And so now, time has passed. Is the sunshine back in your house?
Yeah, Yeah, very much so.
And you've seen that behaviour change? She's singing?
Yeah, now she's singing. She's annoying us all.
I bet you love it now when she annoys you.
Yeah.
She's outward. She's thinking about the world. She's interested in everything. She has gone to secondary school, and I think that's been an amazing thing for her. Because in retrospect, I think that big jump between primary and secondary was one of the things that was causing her anxiety. She's made that jump and it's been wonderful. Last night was her summer performance at school. She was at the front of the stage. She couldn't keep the joy out of her face. It was a sort of musical production. She was sat on a chair, dancing around. She couldn't have done it. She couldn't have done it. Here we go. She couldn't have done it because she couldn't have sat on a chair. She looked like she was completely in her element. I've never seen her in her element like that. Yeah, she's back.
You can sort of try to police a child's food. You won't be able to police her food when she's an adult. Do you worry about what happens when she becomes an adult?
Yeah, I do. And I know that there won't be the support available that if we were to need it when she's an adult. There are some services, but it's not the same at all as it is if you've got a child with an eating disorder. You know, I imagine her going off to university if that's what she does, and I do worry about that. But the way that I reassure myself is that she's actually more aware of these kind of things now than the average student. Most motivated to be better, I think.
And presumably you would say to parents, just get help as soon as you can.
Yeah, getting help was the best thing that we did. That is the thing I'm most proud of. Just find help and don't stop until you found the help you need.
We couldn't have done this if we hadn't had support from a professional service, and I really hope that those services exist. I don't know how people do it if they haven't got access to that. The other thing is, I really hope that having gone through this, one of the silver linings in this is that, you know, this is all happened. This was a 9-year-old girl this happened to, but she's going to go through all the things that adolescent girls have to go through, and I think that I really hope that she will have new resources. I think she's a stronger person for having been through this.
James, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Maggie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Maggie and James. If anything in this podcast affected you or anyone you know, then you can get help from the charity BEAT. They can be emailed at help@beateatingdisorders.org.uk, or they have two helplines, one for adults, 0808 801 0677, and one for young people, 0808 801 0711. Coming up, new evidence about the dangers of using your mobile phone behind the wheel. Now, MPs are suggesting banning the use of hands-free mobile phones while driving after experts warn that they are not safe. Gwyn Topham is The Guardian's transport correspondent.
You think people would know by now about what's dangerous to do behind the wheel. And you see so many people possibly eating a sandwich behind the wheel, having a cigarette, doing any kind of thing, sticking on their makeup. But the one thing that really seems to be most dangerous is using a mobile phone. People seem to think that using a handheld mobile phone is very different from a hands-free device. But according to experts who gave testimony, just the level of distraction involved in a conversation is as bad as being drunk behind the wheel. And that applies whether you're using a hands-free device or whether a handheld device. And that's why a group of MPs, the Transport Select Committee, have now called for the laws to be reviewed and possibly for the government to institute a ban on using hands-free devices. What we've seen after years and years, decades in fact, of increasing road safety improvements, fewer and fewer deaths, over the last decade, death has actually started to flatline, accidents have started to slightly go up. We've seen 43 deaths last year. That's gone up from 15 a decade ago, and 135 serious injuries in accidents linked to mobile phone use. It might not sound that many, but given the context of massively improved car safety, public awareness of things like drink driving, there seems to be one thing that's really bucking the trend. Currently, if you get caught using your mobile phone behind the wheel, a handheld device, not hands-free, you get 6 points on your licence and £200 fine. That's double the penalties of just 2 or 3 years ago, but that doesn't seem to have affected attitudes. There are even attitude surveys conducted by the Department for Transport that prove that the public are even more sceptical now that speaking on the phone is dangerous. It's hard to know why public perception of the risk hasn't kept up with the expert analysis, but I think really it's just the fact that we all use our phones all the time now. They've become almost part of our everyday life, and drivers are certainly no exception. In fact, even more so on a long journey, you might want that phone to be your sat nav. You might well have your Spotify playlist on that phone. There are plenty of ways in which modern cars make your phone a seamless part of the driving experience. However, the fact is, according to the experts, distraction is one of the most dangerous things behind the wheel. Obviously, if you look down at your phone with a handheld device, that does seem a level more dangerous than using a hands-free. But tests in simulators have shown that people take up to 5 minutes to fully recover their concentration after speaking to somebody on a hands-free device. And that's the kind of thing that has really worried MPs in these circumstances. None of us like being told what to do in our home or in our car, but certainly I think this isn't like the war on the motorist. It's basically about saying this is pretty dangerous. We've all changed our attitudes to drink driving more or less, but somehow mobile phones, they've become so ubiquitous, we need them for everything. It's hard to put them down. But when you're behind a wheel, you really need to.
That was Gwyn Topham. My thanks to him and to Maggie, James and Hattie, whose names have been changed. Today's episode was produced by India Rackerson and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Eloise Stevens. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.